congratulations on this great work.
Thank you very much, Tony. I'm glad you enjoyed it, and it's nice to be here with you.
I didn't not only enjoy it, I couldn't put it down, Jerry. I could not put it down.
Well, music to my ears.
What makes this such a great story? I would imagine for you, you were excited to tackle it, but why did you decide to go after this?
There were a lot of things that appealed to me about the project. One of the things was that it was an opportunity to write about a really fascinating era of American history, the progressive era, the Roosevelt years. It was a time when America was changing, and a lot of what we now come to accept as given was being established. The early years of the century were a time when politically, socially, economically, governmentally, all those things were determining the future. America was turning into the modern country that we know today. A lot of that happened around the same time. So that was one attraction as someone who's written about history before. The other thing was that it was an opportunity to tell a story about Theodore Roosevelt, who has to be one of the most fascinating as well as important figures of the 20th century. He was phenomenally popular. We can't grasp how popular he was in his own time among Americans and around the world. He was one of these figures that is just a force of nature larger than life, and the chance to be able to spend 300 or so pages writing about him was also a tremendous draw for me. And the third thing was, I thought the story had a real narrative force to try to harness. It gave me the opportunity to cut back and forth between Roosevelt, on the one hand, on the campaign trail, traveling 10,000 miles, barnstorming via train across the country, speaking to millions of people. And on the other hand, John Schrank, the German immigrant who was tracking him for a month through seven southern and midwestern states with one idea in mind, and that was to shoot him. So this interplay of Roosevelt on the campaign trail and Schrank tracing him, unbeknown to Roosevelt, of course, was very appealing to me as an author.
Were there things in this work that you learned about Roosevelt that kind of stand out to you?
The Roosevelt story was familiar to many people. He was born with a silver spoon in his mouth in New York City. He entered politics at a very young age. He attended Harvard and then Columbia Law School, though he dropped out of Columbia. And then he entered politics. And he was patrician, but he saw public service as a real duty. And he, like Franklin Roosevelt, was called a traitor to his class. He stood for the small person, the worker, the consumer, and raised a lot of feathers along the way. You know, I had a basic familiarity with Roosevelt's biography and with his political trajectory, his career. But I think the thing that most surprised me about him is what I mentioned before, just how incredibly popular he was. When you get into the story and you read the letters that people sent to him, or you see photographs of him on the campaign trail with the streets around where he was speaking just choked with people for blocks in every direction. In small towns in the Midwest, or small cities, I should say, in the Midwest, he would routinely attract 10,000 people into an auditorium to hear him speak. I mean, I knew that Roosevelt was popular. I knew he'd been reelected for the second term. But I think I didn't realize the depth of people's love for him, really love for him, until I started doing the book. I have to say, in terms of Roosevelt, that was probably the biggest surprise.
As you paint the picture, Schrank is looking for the right opportunity to get a shot at this guy, and he goes to several different places, and you trace it along the way, step for step. This is where Schrank checks in. This is the hour he arrives. Schrank's acting all alone, but yet he can't get the right opportunity because this guy is so beloved. It's hard to get close to him, isn't it?
Yes, it's hard to get close to him, and also Schrank, there were three times that he was able to get close to Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. And he missed. The first one was in Atlanta, where Roosevelt was speaking in an auditorium of 10,000 people. This is in the South, which was not Republican in those days. Roosevelt was not a popular person. Mm-hmm. And while he was giving his speech, he was heckled. And he shouted the people, the hecklers, down a couple of times. And then finally, he jumped up on a table that had been put on the dais And he said to the hecklers, this is a paraphrase, I don't remember the exact words, he said, I'm going to speak and you're going to listen. And then they were quiet for the rest of the evening. But because of that disturbance, his handlers took him out a side door of the auditorium. And there's John Schrank standing in front with his gun in his pocket, where he did manage to get close to the front door, but Roosevelt managed to escape out the side. The second time that Schrank just narrowly missed him was in Chattanooga, where he'd been trailing Roosevelt for about a week at this point. And he, again, pushed to the front of the curb where Roosevelt's car was going to pass when he came in from the Chattanooga train station. And Schrank is standing there with his hand in his pocket with a gun in it. And the car went within 10 feet of him, and he lost his nerve. It was the first time he had seen Roosevelt. And when it came to it, he just couldn't make himself do it. Then a couple of weeks later, he narrowly missed him again in Chicago, where again, he was standing at the wrong door at the wrong time. And finally, their paths crossed in Milwaukee, and that time Schrank did get close enough, and he shot him.
I'll tell you what was really haunting about this book, and I don't know in the interviews that you've done with folks, if folks have used the term haunting to you, but what sort of haunted me was that this Schrank fellow was a madman, in a sense. And in fact, the court of law, they found him insane when he was tried in the latter part of the book. But what's really something is how he felt like he was doing God's duty. And it came from a right. vision. Share with us the vision that Schrank had.
Right. It's one dream and one vision. The dream happened first. It was in September of 1901. It was the night that William McKinley was assassinated. And of course, Theodore Roosevelt was his vice president, so that's how Roosevelt first ascended to the presidency, through McKinley's assassination. The United States had seen three presidents gunned down over the course of 36 years. And the country, it was Lincoln, Garfield, and then McKinley. And the country was just overwhelmed by McKinley's death. And so was John Schrank. And that night, the night that McKinley died, John Schrank went to sleep in his cheap hotel room in New York where he lived on the Lower East Side. And he had a dream where he saw William McKinley lying in his coffin. And Schrank approached the coffin. And McKinley sat up and pointed a cadaverous finger toward the corner of the room. And Schrank followed where he was pointing. And he saw a figure in a brown monk's robe with a cowl with a hood over his head. And Schrank looked and he recognized the face of Theodore Roosevelt. He could see the teeth and the spectacles. And McKinley pointed to Roosevelt and said, "This is my true assassin. Avenge my death." And Schrank woke up from the dream. It was a very powerful dream that never left him. But even though he had had the summons from no less than the late president, Schrank didn't do anything about it until 11 years later, when Roosevelt was running for a third term as president, 4 years off, while Taft was president, and then he decided he was going to run again for what would have been a third term, although they weren't contiguous. And Schrank, that night, it was exactly 11 years, almost to the hour, from when he had his first dream. Schrank couldn't sleep, and he was sitting up. He was a compulsive writer. He wrote essays and aphorisms and poetry, and he was sitting up at his work table at 1 o'clock in the morning, finishing this poem that he had started before he went to bed. "Be a Man," it was called, and it was about the requirements of manly duty and how you had to meet your duty and be a man, even if it meant your own death. And as he was sitting there writing, he felt a tap on his left shoulder, and he looked, and it was William McKinley standing in the room with him, and he repeated his earlier command, "Theodore Roosevelt is my true assassin. Avenge my death." And that time, after having this vision, Schrank realized that he had a divine calling to put an end to Theodore Roosevelt's plans for a third term. And shortly after that, he went out to a gun store on Broadway in Manhattan and bought an illegal pistol because he didn't have a permit. and started tracking Roosevelt around the country.
Jerry Helfrich is our guest. Roosevelt and the Assassin, Madness, Vengeance, and the Campaign of 1912, available from Lions Press. Such an interesting book. I'm telling you, you pick this thing up, and you will not be able to put it down. And the characters in it, you talk about this madman who you were just the vision, the dream. And then there's Roosevelt. And then against this backdrop, there's a four-way presidential race. Could you imagine if we had something like that today in American politics, a four-way race, including a two-term president of the United States of America, as you said, not contiguous in terms of his term, but still at the same time, what a crazy time that must have been in American politics 100 years ago.
It's been called the most fascinating election in American presidential history. The four candidates were Taft, William Howard Taft, who got the Republican nomination, Roosevelt, who of course wanted the Republican nomination, and he won the lion's share of the Republican primaries, which were a brand new innovation in 1912, but he didn't have enough delegates from the primaries, and at the convention, the nomination went to Taft. So instead, Roosevelt started the Progressive Party, the Bull Moose Party, and ran against the Republican incumbent, left his own party. Then running for the Socialists was Eugene Debs, who'd come up as a labor organizer, a railroad union organizer. He was making his fourth run at the presidency in 1912, and he was a brilliant speaker, a dedicated person, someone who really believed in his platform, which was quite radical and included things like public ownership of banks and railroads, the elimination of the U.S. Senate. It was clear that Debs was not going to be elected. Even Debs didn't believe he was going to be elected. But he did manage to get almost a million votes in 1912, which was about 6% of the electorate. In terms of percentage, it's the most votes that the Socialist Party ever got before or after. And then, of course, running for the Democrats, you had Woodrow Wilson, president of Princeton University, who went on to be governor of the state of New Jersey. It was clear from the beginning that Wilson had the advantage because the Republicans had been split. Roosevelt and Taft were going to split the Republican vote somewhat between them. So the Democrats knew that they had a great opportunity to win the election. And there weren't that many differences, really, between Roosevelt and Wilson in terms of platform. They both supported democratic reforms such as direct primaries. They both believed in reducing the tariff, which was a major bone of contention between Republicans and Democrats for 25 years. And they both believed that the corporations had gotten too powerful. Their main area of disagreement was how to rein in the corporations. Roosevelt always felt, and he did this as president, that in order to counterbalance the weight of the corporations, you had to use strong force of the federal government through regulation. The federal government had to regulate the corporations through laws, through the creation of things like the Food and Drug Act, which happened during Roosevelt's term as president, through creation of government departments, like the Department of Commerce, for instance. So Roosevelt believed in big government versus big corporations. Wilson had a slightly different view. He believed in relatively smaller government, and he felt that the way to counterbalance the effect of the trusts was to encourage competition, to make it easier for other companies to enter the market and compete directly with the trusts. So that was the campaign in a nutshell. Wilson, of course, went on to win the election in 1912 and won again in 1916. But by the time he was running for re-election in 1916, he had actually put into effect every plank in Roosevelt's platform from 1912. Wilson, once he got to be president, realized that the way to control the corporations was actually what Roosevelt had said all along, that the government needed to be as strong as the corporation. And in fact, that's what he did as president. He established the National Bank and signed other legislation to rein in the corporations exactly the way Roosevelt would have done if he were elected. A couple of other interesting things about the election in 1912, it was just the way away the era in many ways. It was the beginning of the modern era. Mm-hmm. It was the beginning of modern politics. It was the first presidential election where primaries played any kind of role, and the primaries meant a much longer campaign season. It meant the candidates had to get out on the stump earlier and campaign. It meant that they spent more money. It was a longer campaign season. It was a more expensive campaign season. And that meant that the candidates had to start raising money in a way they never have before. And that money came from the corporations and from wealthy donors. About three-quarters of the money donated to the major political parties that year came from the board members, owners of the corporations, directly as individuals. It was also the first election where the press played a major role, because the candidates had press corps traveling with them and filing daily stories about their speeches and their activities. It was the first presidential campaign where women played any significant role. Women didn't yet have the vote, but Roosevelt was the first male politician of any stature to advocate the vote for women. And so women campaigned on his behalf across the country. The election in 1912 set the stage for a lot of things that came after it.
Yeah, things that we see to this day, which I find remarkable. In fact, let's go back to the campaign. Right at the very end is when this madman assassin, as we visit today, our special guest joining us is Jerry Helfrich, who is the author of Theodore Roosevelt and the Assassin, Madness, Vengeance, and the Campaign of 1912. And so we're towards the end of the cycle there in the campaign, and this madman finally gets the nerve and the opportunity, and they're in Milwaukee, to take a shot, which he does. And the way you set that up is so interesting, because it's time, place, and opportunity, and he just happened to be in the right place at the right time, where Roosevelt comes out of a hotel, right? He was on his way to an event. Isn't that what happened? And he gets shot there. Roosevelt, though, is hard-headed from the word go, but something he told himself in the military was, if he ever was wounded in action, you cited this, he was going to finish his job, whatever the job was in front of him. He went and spoke, not knowing how injured he was. He went and spoke. And here's the thing that's remarkable to me, and I'd like you to expound on this. If it's 100 years later, if a man gets shot on his way to some kind of event, in the America we live in today, that guy would get elected president. There would be some kind of groundswell. That's how we are today. We don't worry about...
After Roosevelt was shot, it was one of those things that really showed Roosevelt's personality. If you can imagine the differences between then and now in terms of the campaign, Roosevelt is always out among the people during the campaign. He's speaking from railroad cars. He's pushing his way from the car to get into venues where he's speaking. And he has no security. The Secret Service protected the president at that time, but didn't protect presidential candidates. So Roosevelt is out among tens of thousands of people, basically by himself. He has a few supporters to help him, a few of his staff. There's one, a former Rough Rider colonel, who carried a pistol. But he's really vulnerable in a way we can't imagine now. So when Roosevelt got to Milwaukee the night he was shot, he was exhausted. He was finishing this tour. His voice was gone. He just wanted to stay in his car, in his railroad car, and eat with a few staff members. But the local committee persuaded him to go to this hotel where people were waiting for him. A local progressive committee supporters were there. He didn't want to disappoint them. So he went. They had dinner. He was leaving to go across town to speak at the auditorium. And as he walks out of the hotel lobby, out into the street, it's dark. He's silhouetted against the door. And there's nothing between Roosevelt's car and this huge mob that is around it. Schrank has managed to push his way within 10 feet of the car, and he gets off a single round. As he does, one of Roosevelt's stenographers sees the pistol go up before he fires, and he can't stop the first shot, but he stops the second and probably saved Roosevelt's life. But still, Roosevelt is shot in the chest from a distance of 10 feet. And this is something else that's just impossible to imagine these days. He insists on going to the auditorium where all these people are waiting for him. And the staff cannot persuade him to be taken to the hospital. So he goes, he stands on the stage, he's introduced, and he stands on the stage and he says to this packed want you to know I have a whole speech prepared here, but I'm not going to be able to give it all because I've been shot. And a cry goes up in the audience somewhere, fake, fake. So he opens his coat, and he exposes his bloody shirt and his bloody white vest, and there's screams in the audience, and then people believe him. He says, so I'm not going to be able to speak for very long. And then he goes on, and he gives a speech for 80 minutes before he finally agrees to be taken to the hospital.
So, Jerry, just so people hear this, here's a guy that had just gotten shot, and he went and spoke for 80 minutes, did you say?
That's right.
That's remarkable.
It's incredible. As I say, it's something that really shows the force of Roosevelt's personality.
Another thing that I think showed the force or a side of him, he said, bring me my perpetrator. As soon as he was shot, he wanted to see him.
That's right.
It's almost as if he looked at that man not in a condemning sense, at least in the picture you paint.
Right. He said he wanted to look at him, and so they dragged Schrank. Schrank had been tackled, and of course, there were a lot of people holding him. The gun had been taken away from him, and he went right up to the side of Roosevelt's car, and Roosevelt looked in his eyes, and then he said, you know, take this man away and make sure that no one hurts him. And Schrank was led through the hotel, back not out into the crowd, but into the hotel, and back out through the hotel kitchen where there was an alley, and he was put in a police car and taken to the station. And even then, a group of men chased the police car, shouting, lynch him, kill him, kill him. And they just barely managed to get him inside the sheriff's department safely.
And Schrank was so matter-of-fact about the whole thing. His meeting with the police, his apologizing to the fact that it had to be done in Milwaukee. He even apologized to those folks.
That's right. One of the reasons he failed in Chicago, Roosevelt made two speeches in Chicago, and Schrank was there and saw Roosevelt go into his hotel in Chicago, but he didn't even bring his gun to that particular occasion. And it was because he didn't want to insult the people of Chicago. He didn't want to ruin their fine and decent reception of Roosevelt. And even after he shot him in Milwaukee, he apologized to the people of Milwaukee for the smirch on the reputation of the city, the spot. But at the same time, he didn't apologize for the crime. He felt that it was something that had to be done, that if Roosevelt, by the fact that he was running for a third term, he believed Roosevelt was going to cause another civil war, and he was going to cause a foreign invasion of the United States. And he felt that it was absolutely essential for Roosevelt to be stopped and for a precedent to be made that no one is going to have a third term as president. So he never regretted what he did. Ironically, he lived long enough to see Franklin Roosevelt, Theodore's distant cousin, elected to a third term as president. But by then, he was in a mental institution and there was nothing he could do about it. But he did continue to follow the newspapers and current events, and he knew that it had happened, and he was very upset by it. But as I say, at that point, he couldn't do anything.
Jerry Helfrich is our guest. The book is Theodore Roosevelt and the Assassin, Madness, Vengeance, the Campaign of 1912. Towards the end of the book, you talk about all these events and the confluence of them and how you have this attempted assassination and then the election a short while later. And the point I was trying to make before that, I don't know if I made it, but if you had the news cycle today and you had a guy that stood up there and spoke for 80 minutes after being shot that night, the way people would view him these days, I would think would really help him in that election. Especially when he was already a two-term president. And back then, things were so much different in terms of the press, the way that news was disseminated, that it wasn't a slam dunk for him. In fact, at the end there, he just kind of fizzled, didn't he, in the election, speaking of Roosevelt.
After he was shot, he basically suspended his campaign. He spent about a week. They took him immediately after he was stabilized in Milwaukee, they took him immediately to Chicago, which is about 90 miles away, because it was a better hospital. It was a major hospital there. It still exists, Mercy Hospital. And he was in the hospital there for about a week, and then he went back to Oyster Bay on Long Island to recuperate. And he never was able to campaign again. The only other appearance he made during the election was to speak at Madison Square Garden. It was around Halloween, right before the election. And it was basically his valedictory, his farewell to political life. He gave a long talk, again, enthusiastic crowd, quoted in the newspapers, but that was basically the end of the campaign. It has to be said in Wilson's favor, though, that once Roosevelt was shot, he suspended his campaigning, too. So for all intents and purposes, once the shooting took place for the next 2-3 weeks before the election day, all campaigning had stopped. But, of course, Wilson was elected by a large plurality, a very large electoral college vote. Roosevelt carried 8 states, and Taft carried 2. It was the first and only time in American presidential election history that a third-party candidate outpolled one of the other 2 major parties. But this time, Roosevelt did. He did better than Taft, but not nearly well enough to beat Wilson. Roosevelt was tremendously popular. And if you were running on the Republican ticket, there's an excellent chance. Historians are split on this, but there's an excellent chance he would have been elected. But having split the party with Taft, there was just no way that they could overcome that. And it was fairly clear sailing for Wilson.
Jerry, where do you fall on that? Would he have won the election if he was the Republican ticket?
I don't know. I can't honestly say. I wouldn't be surprised because of his tremendous popularity. He was certainly much more popular than Wilson was, and he was much more popular as president than Wilson was as president. Wilson was given a second term largely on the fact that he had kept America out of World War I up until that point, up until he was reelected in 1916. But then later in his career, Wilson was not very popular, and of course, he'd had a stroke and wouldn't have been able to run for re-election for a third term anyway. But I think there's no question that he wouldn't have been elected even if he were healthy and he had run. And I think that kind of that cult of popularity that Roosevelt enjoyed is hard for a competing politician to overcome. So as I say, I think there's a good chance Roosevelt would have been elected. But it's something that I think I'll let historians argue about.
Hey, Jerry, I really appreciate your time. Congratulations on this work.
No, it's been a pleasure, Tony. Thank you so much.
And Jerry, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure, Tony. Thank you.